Hello, I'm Oliver Wong. Morgan Rhodes is out this week, so I'll be driving things solo for Heat Rocks. Every episode, we invite a guest to join us to talk about a Heat Rock, a.k.a. an eternal flame of an album. Shout out to the Bangles. Today, we're rolling things back nearly 30 years to the album Violator by the kings of 80s synth-pop, Depeche Mode. In June of 1988, I, along with 60,000 others, filled the Rose Bowl to witness the 101st concert on the Music for the Masses tour, headlined by the legends of Basildon, Depeche Mode. Seated at the very back of the field seats, I watched opening acts like Thomas Dolby and OMD, along with the DJs representing LA's modern rock station K-Rock, shout out to Poor Man and Richard Blade, help set things up for Depeche Mode, who are proving that synth pop wasn't just for dance floors, it could fill stadiums as well. The 101 concert was my first ever pop music show, and I picked a hell of an introduction to the world of live music, but being at 101 is a memory I'll never forget, especially when it began to rain in June in Los Angeles during the group's performance of Blasphemous Rumors. Back then, it was hard to imagine Depeche becoming even bigger than they already were, but in less than 2 years, I'd be proven wrong. Violator came out in early March of 1990, and on the strength of such hits as Personal Jesus, Enjoy the Silence, and Policy of Truth, Violator became the group's biggest album ever, going over 4.5 times platinum in the U.S. alone. Pitchfork's Nitsu Abebe, revisiting this album and two others by the group in 2006, described its success as partially being a result of how it, quote, gave electronic music the human feel of teenage anthems and power ballads, unquote. And if Depeche Mode did nothing else in their heyday, it was showing that a bunch of musicians standing around synthesizers and drum machines could get as emo as anyone with an acoustic guitar and a pocket full of woe.
As years go by, all the feelings inside twist and they turn as they ride with the tides. I don't advise and I don't criticize, I just...
Violator was the album pick of our guest today, writer and scholar Hua Xu. Hua has been a staff writer at The New Yorker since 2017, and he's written on everything from Lauren Berlant's affect theory to the politics of affirmative action to the role of nostalgia in pop music. Hua is also an associate professor of English at Vassar College and author of The Floating Chinaman, Fantasy and Failure Across the Pacific. He's also one of my oldest and closest friends, someone who I literally talk to almost every day, just very rarely in person, so I'm delighted he's in town. Hua Xu, welcome to Heat Rocks.
Man, it's so awesome to be here. It's funny because we do talk pretty frequently, and yet you probably were shocked when I picked Violator.
I don't think I was shocked by the pick of a Depeche Mode album. I think Violator surprised me, but then I forgot that you're 5 years younger than me, and therefore it would kind of make sense that this Depeche album, as opposed to Music for the Masses, which came out 2 years before that, or for me, like the pivotal Depeche album was actually their greatest hits anthology from the mid-80s, catching up with the Depeche Mode. But again, you would have been, what, like 13, 14 when this album first came out?
Yeah, 13, 12, I think.
Okay. So before we even get to this point, though, when we were talking about what you wanted to pick for this show today, I think more than most of our guests, you really, really deliberated over what album to choose, which is strange to me as someone who is surrounded by music all the time. Why was it so hard for you to find an album to talk about?
You know, I listen to the show a lot, and I love the insights that people bring to bear on these albums they choose, and I just feel like I don't necessarily have that kind of relationship with any one album.
Mm.
And maybe just the product of being a critic, I don't really have that many things to say about things I truly love sometimes. And so, you know, like, I love Pharoah Sanders' Jewels of Thought, but I could probably only talk about it for a few minutes before wanting to just play the whole album for you.
Got it.
But for whatever reason, you know, Violator is something I picked up again maybe like 7 or 8 years ago. And it's something I listen to really constantly, probably more so than I did in 1990 when it came out.
Yeah. Were you a Depeche fan growing up?
You know, I wasn't actually that into music circa 1990.
Mm.
My dad was really into music. He's into the Beatles, sort of all that. Everything you would be into if you came to the United States in like 1972.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I grew up with a lot of music in my household, but I didn't really think of music as my own thing.
Mm.
And so I think around 1990, you know, I think I was, you know, 12, 13. I was
still in middle school, right?
Yeah, I was kind of getting into music, trying to figure out an identity around music. And I had an older cousin, shout out Johan, who was, I believe, 4 years older than me. It's sort of hard to recover this now, but I think in the 70s and 80s, a lot of music discovery was just if you had an older sibling,
yeah.
if you had an older cousin, if an upperclassman at school had a sticker on their locker. I feel like that's how I learned about a lot of these bands. And,
yeah.
you know, I had this weird memory around this time of like a really popular kid at our school, an athlete, had a Smith sticker mm-hmm. on his locker. And, you know, at the time, you had no idea what these bands sounded like. So I automatically assumed the Smiths must be just the hardest, heaviest band ever if that guy was into them, you know. And in reality, he was just like an extremely sensitive,
yeah.
like beautiful man, you know.
I mean, Johnny Marr kind of killed it on the guitar, though. So
yeah, yeah.
But they were not a punk group by any stretch of the term. It's funny that you were mentioning that it was your older cousin, Johan, who put you up in Depeche, because for me, it was also my older cousin, Phil, who was 2 years older than I. And before I discovered hip-hop, I was heavy, heavy into new wave, modern rock, synth pop,
yeah.
whatever you want to call it. And a lot of it was directly shaped because that's what Phil and his friends listened to, and therefore it's what I kind of caught through osmosis, if you will.
Yeah, there's definitely this strange thing, that, and maybe this is why I've been listening to a lot more lately, just trying to wrap my head around it, but you know, there is this sensibility that's distinctly kind of 80s suburban Asian American. You listen to
yes.
new wave, you listen to sort of cold emotional synth pop. You know, a lot of people have thought about this. I've had a lot of like drunken conversation with friends about
yeah.
like why Bizarre Love Triangle seemed like
our anthem.
Like the Asian American national anthem
yeah.
circa like 1989.
Sure.
I think that's why that cohort effect really took root, you know, because you know, Johan heard it from, you know, someone who's probably older than him. And then I heard it. And I never really felt like the music was necessarily mine in that respect. Like, mm-hmm. I think the next year, Nirvana's Nevermind came out. And that was, for me, this, like, cataclysmic moment.
Right. That album felt like it belonged to you in a different way than perhaps Violator did.
Yeah, because I was, at the time, I was, like, 14 and Nevermind drops. And
right.
It completely changes all my perception of, like, what's possible in a market economy. Not that that's how I thought about it in that moment, but
yeah,
I was really shocked to find out later on that like Depeche Mode fans don't like Violator that much, at least as much as the albums that directly preceded it.
Right. And I'm not by any means a hardcore Depeche Mode fan, but yeah, Violator was never my personal favorite only because it wasn't the pivotal album that was my introduction to the group. That was The Greatest Hits, Catching Up with Depeche Mode. And then Music for the Masses is the album that dropped around the time that I turned 16 and therefore could drive. And of mm-hmm. course, for someone who grew up in LA, having access to your license, being able to drive on your own, it just increases the amount of music you listen to. And so I think the songs off of that album are a little bit more formative, even though simply being in the world in 1990, well, I should say being in Los Angeles in 1990, there's no way that you could escape Personal Jesus or Enjoy the Silence because those were so big hits, especially on the alt-rock and modern rock stations.
Yeah.
But to bring this back to why you wanted to talk about Violator, and you were saying how there are other albums that you just adore, like a Pharoah Saunders album, you just don't necessarily have a lot to say about it. So what is it about Violator that triggers a cascade of thoughts in a way that some other albums that might be more of what you might describe as your Desert Island Disc? Violator doesn't sound like a Desert Island Disc for you, but it is something that you got thoughts on. Why?
You know, it would be like it's definitely something that never leaves my my iPhone. But I think it's just exactly what you just said. Listening to it so much over the years, it does sort of trigger these things that in retrospect, I didn't really have the language for the age of 12 or 13. And I think it wasn't until I was in my 20s and I realized that, like, Morrissey had this huge, like, Chicano fan base. That I realized that how formative the sound of Erasure, Pet Shop Boys, Depeche Mode, Alphaville, New Order, The Cure, how formative this sound was to, I don't know, just like an emerging sense of like being a young Asian person in America in the 80s. And so when I listen to it now, you know, I still don't quite understand the depth of like yearning and lust and longing that Dave Gahan is singing about. But it reminds me of the confusion of hearing that for the first time when I was younger. And the sense of, you know, he's a huge rock star. Like if you go back and watch Depeche Mode 101, like they were stars. And yet the song, these are songs about like alienation and sadness and isolation. And, you know, you could say that it was all a pose, that it was all just artifice. But, you know, like he's had an interesting life in the shadow of all that. And so I think revisiting it now, it just seems a lot more mysterious. But when I was younger, like I didn't understand what that mystery was standing in for, like what that mystery, what the emotional roots of that mystery like could be.
You've now alluded to the this twice now about the ways in which the music of Depeche Mode, in addition to a lot of other new wave and synth pop acts of that era, have some particular resonance. And I don't want to paint with too broad a brush here, so I will at least limit it to Asian Americans who grew up in the West Coast and were 70s and 80s babies, that for whatever reason, like our like
suburban,
yes, that our peoples really gravitated to this kind of music. And certainly that was true for myself. It was true for my friends in high school. You know, I think the holy triumvirate of albums that a teenage Asian American, at least in LA, would have was going to be probably Catching Up with Depeche Mode. It was going to be New Order Substance, which is another greatest hits compilation. It was going to be Circus by Erasure, right? Like you can count on those three would just be in their collection. And I think half jokingly, but also half serious, I have had this conversation with, you know, my fellow Asians over the years, including with you, including with our friend Todd Inouye up in the Bay Area. And I have, we've collected a variety of theories, and I'm wondering which ones do you think explain it the best? Like, what is it about modern rock that, for Asian Americans in particular, at least suburban Asian Americans on the West Coast, what is it about it, this music that did it for us?
You know, I appreciate you allowing me to come on to the show and float some of these theories. I'm sure this is very niche content, but it's true. I mean, I think like right now I'm curating the show at the Museum of Chinese America, and in New York, and I was really insistent that, you know, we talk about Asian goths in the 80s. And when I talk to other people at the show, they're sort of like, what is that? Like, what are you talking about? Because it does seem like this very fleeting moment. And yet, when I raise this with people to sort of like talking about the show, like my cousin Eugene, who's a bit older than both Johan and I, said, when I was growing up, I thought Depeche Mode were Asian because only Asian people listened to Depeche Mode. So like he thought that this group that was actually from, you know, like a dreary part of England, rock star, he thought that these were like Asian people making this music, because other Asian people in high school and middle school just glommed onto them so much. So my friend Chris and I had this, had a whole set of theories, and a lot of them revolved around the fact that this isn't music that's necessarily guitar centric.
Right.
And so that kind of normative rock pose of like the dude playing a guitar solo, like that wasn't necessarily front and center in Depeche Mode. And so the sound of Depeche Mode is very much, you know, it's synth pop. And so it's very much about keyboards, synthesizers, electronic string sounds. And these are all sounds that, you know, if you really wanted to go there with this theory, these were like indigenous sounds to an Asian immigrant kid, right, who had been forced to play the piano, forced to play the violin. You know, you could approximate this music while you were practicing the piano,
right,
while you were practicing your like Yamaha keyboard.
Right.
And so I think that combination of it not being really guitar driven, but it also being, you know, it's like unusual sounding music. It doesn't really sound like classical music. It doesn't really have these antecedents that I think when you're young and finding your place in the world, mark it as part of history, you know? And so I think that was kind of exciting for me, at least, just this idea that this music just sounded more like technology or the future. And yet it's also really emotional. And so the songs are also about this kind of outsiderishness, alienation, that I think felt really native to a lot of immigrant kids too.
Yeah, no doubt.
You know, that's often what people talk about with like the Smiths and Morrissey and their like huge popularity among like
Chicanos and Latinos, right.
And it seems like such a stretch, especially now when we look back at sort of Morrissey and his politics, but I think that's pretty real, you know, just that you don't necessarily have to relate to someone to relate to the kind of emotional possibilities, especially if they're kind of marginal and weird emotional possibilities.
I really love this idea that as kids who had to grow up with requisite piano lessons, we really identified with synth heavy music. No, I buy that to a certain extent. Like, is there a Suzuki method for playing the greatest hits of Factory Records? I don't know. They probably should have been. It would have been a missed opportunity if not. I think the alienation thing makes a lot of sense. And certainly this is, I think people who write about what it's like to grow up in the suburbs, this is a very common theme, though I think it's often associated with other kinds of music, you know, very emo, more folky acoustic guitar stuff. And the fact that for whatever reason, you know, our generation maybe have glommed onto these synth pop giants instead, thematically it still works, even if musically it seems a little bit unusual. I still don't really have a reason not to depart the Depeche Mode train for a moment. I still don't know why Bizarre Love Triangle by New Order is the Asian American national anthem, at least for a particular generation. All I know is that it unequivocally is. Like, this is undeniable. Like, no one would ever disagree with that assessment. But what about that song in particular? I don't really know, because to this day, I don't really know what the song is about besides a bizarre love triangle. But if you listen to the lyrics, it's like, is someone breaking up? And then who's in the triangle? None of these things are very clear in the tune. But again, it is something that we just know, yeah, that is the anthem for whatever reason it might be.
Obviously, these were all enormously successful artists, you know, so it's not as though they were some sort of cult secret among these groups. But I just think that they just articulated something a little different. They offered a different sensibility. They also weren't necessarily like the sexuality was really sublimated in this interesting way. So it wasn't just like aggressive and masculine, even though I think almost everyone on all these records, except for a member of New Order, are like men.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, like Pet Shop Boys, Erasure, there's a lot of like, there's a lot of overt and then like figurative, like queer themes.
Absolutely.
And, like, and,
right.
And possibilities there. So I think it just sort of appealed to people who didn't necessarily see themselves represented or reflected in whatever you wanted to call like the mainstream at the time.
Right.
You know, like I feel like I just kind of randomly started listening to Violator again. And then a few years ago, I saw this film that it's one of the most incredible music films I've ever seen. It's called The Posters Came from the Walls by Nick Abrahams and Jeremy Deller, these two British artists. And it's essentially this film about that era of Depeche Mode and what they meant to different people around the world. And so I think it was originally meant as a tribute to the band on some kind of anniversary for some box set. But the band actually is barely in the film. Instead, you get these pockets of, you know, people who are at the infamous Warehouse Records, quote unquote, riot.
Here in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where the security staff of the Warehouse record store didn't realize that like
20,000 people were going to show up.
Yeah. And so it wasn't there. It wasn't really a riot. But I think once the LAPD showed up, it just seemed like, you know, if you look at those news broadcasts, nobody has any idea who Depeche Mode is.
Crowd control problem in West LA tonight as thousands of teenage fans of the rock band Depeche Mode crammed the area near that shopping center for a chance to meet their heroes.
They're more composers than anything. They're original. They're on the leading edge of every form of music there is.
We thought it was going to be about 30 people. And it turns out it's about 17 to 20,000. It's like unbelievable.
Police say that a crowd that had waited for hours to see the British group Depeche Mode turned ugly, breaking windows, throwing bottles. Police have had to make several arrests, and the band was forced to leave early.
Seems like I haven't seen that since the days of the Beatles.
All the fans say their wait is worth it. Sure is a traffic jam, I'll tell you. That's tonight's Hollywood Report.
And so even though they were these huge pop stars, 20,000 people would show up, they still felt a bit like a secret.
Right.
So, you know, there's someone who was at that show who talks about her experience. One of the interesting things about it is that in 1988, for some reason that I don't quite understand, a Depeche Mode Greatest Hits cassette circulated in East Germany, like around this period of time. And so in 1988, the band was actually allowed to perform in East Berlin.
Mm.
And so for Germans of a certain era, like Depeche Mode was the only modern Western music they knew.
Mm.
And so you just think about that. Like that must be pretty bizarre if your archetype for Western pop music is like Depeche Mode. And the Berlin Wall comes down in June 1990. That's right when Violator is really blowing up worldwide.
Right. Yeah.
And so there's this generation of sort of former communist countries, especially people in East Berlin, East Germany, who, you know, that was the first music they heard once the wall came down. That was their re-entry into kind of the global community. And so the film really, you know, it gave me a lot to think about. There isn't a chapter on sort of Asian American synth pop, which is my only real critique of the film. But, you know, it's really powerful to see how people around the world saw themselves reflected in these songs when very few of us have any grasp of like where they came from or,
right.
you know, the personal struggles they were going through.
It's funny that you should mention this because when I was simply prepping for the intro and I wasn't really thinking that closely, I described Depeche Mode as a group out of Germany. And then I went to figure, well, I should identify the city, like were they from Berlin? And then I went to the Wikipedia page. It's like, no, they're not German. They're English. They're from Essex. And even though in the back of my head somewhere, I must know that they're an English group, I always think of them as being very much a German group. And I think a lot of it is just the sound of their music has that kind of brutalist, cold, dark feel, which I guess I'm generalizing or stereotyping Germans in the process. But it is something like it's very mechanical, machine-like. And this is a theme, of course, in a lot of their early and mid-80s albums. So much of the work and what makes Depeche Mode feel like Depeche Mode is carried in that really flat, affectless style in which he sings. It really enhances that chilly aesthetic that I just associate with so much of their music.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I think that's one of my favorite aspects of it. Like something similar happens with Barney Sumner in New Order, mm-hmm. but he just sounds like he's a little out of it, you know, or he sounds like he's not necessarily a slacker, but there's like a charm to listening to Barney Sumner sing over.
It's not as heavy.
Yeah.
I mean, it's similar, like their vocal range is somewhere in the same ballpark, but you're right. You don't listen to a New Order song, it doesn't feel as heavy in the way that like a lot of Depeche songs feel really heavy.
Yeah, and I think Dave Gahn's voice just has it does have this strange kind of like operatic weariness. Like it feels very affected. So if you listen to something like the 101 concert album, when he's bantering, he just sounds like a normal human being. And then when he starts singing, he sort of lapses into that.
Right.
Like he's a medium or something.
Right.
But that's what I love about this album. Like I think that there's a song like Policy of Truth, for example, where the rhythm is just, it's almost like, it's a very defined structure. And to hear him sing over it, like I just appreciate the tension of that. I think these are just unusually good songs too.
Yeah.
Beyond the fact that they speak to some like weird Asian part of me.
Never again is what you swore the time before.
Policy of Truth for me was the song where I thought, like, oh, I actually really like this band a lot, because there was just something about the electronic drums and the synths, and then that sort of like almost cheesy horn. I feel like that became the sort of archetype for the kind of music I would go on to really love. Like once I got into electro and sort of post-disco electronic music, I just love that kind of sound now. And I think that was the first time I heard something like that.
We will be back with more of our conversation with Hua Shu about Violator by Depeche Mode after a brief word from a couple of our sibling Max Fun podcasts. Keep it locked.
Hi, it's Ali Kokesh, one of the cast members of Mission to Zix, a new addition to the Max Fun Network. We're blown away by the welcome we've received from Max Fun listeners, telling us you've discovered the show and are binging it hard, supporting us during the drive, and just being rad humans all around. Mission to Zix is an improvised, obsessively sound-designed sci-fi comedy epic
following a group of ambassadors as they explore the ass end of space. I play Dar, the 12-foot-tall omnisexual security officer with furry scales, chest talons, and a series of flaps and chutes that are for... Yeah, you know what? You'll figure it out. We'd be delighted if you joined our crew aboard the aging sentient starship, the Bargerian Jade, as we travel the Zix Quadrant, meeting all sorts of weird aliens played by brilliant guest comedians. That's Mission to Zix, ZYXX.
I can't hear myself, but I'm assuming.
These are real podcast listeners, not actors.
Hey, thanks for coming. Here's a list of descriptors. What would you choose to describe the perfect podcast?
I mean, vulgarity.
Dumb. Definitely dumb.
And like, right here, this one, meritless.
What if I told you there was a podcast that did have all of that?
No.
Jordan, Jesse, Go. And it's free.
Jordan, Jesse, Go?
Jordan, Jesse, Go.
Jordan, Jesse, Go. A real podcast.
We're back on Heat Rocks, talking about Violator, the 1990 album by Depeche Mode, with writer and scholar Hua Shu. So Hua, before we went to break, we're talking about just the sound that you really love, especially in a song like Policy of Truth. And I found this quote in prepping for today about, and this comes from Martin Gore, who's the group's guitarist and as well as the primary songwriter. And he said that during the making of the album, quote, "We recorded the majority of Violator in Milan, which was really good fun. How we got anything done, I don't know, because we were out partying most nights," unquote. And I got to say, Violator does not really sound to me like an album recorded by dudes partying so hard they didn't have time to actually record it. I think on Policy of Truth, listening to that again just now, there is kind of, you can see how it works on the dance floor, but maybe it's because I always just think of Depeche Mode through this, as I was using that this term before, the heaviness of it. It's weird for me to imagine Depeche as a bunch of guys who like party, you know? Like, what does it even look like, really?
Well, there's that tour film that D.A. Pennebaker made around the 101 tour, around that tour, and... Yeah. You know, it's refreshing to see that they're just like these normal people.
Sure.
In fact, I think that's another one of these things. Like for me, if we had been doing this, I don't know, if podcasts existed 15 years ago and we were doing this, I probably wouldn't have chosen Violator. But I think one of the reasons it's aged so well is that I think I've just come to admire the band more. Mm. And part of that is finding out that Dave Gahan is a Knicks fan.
Yeah.
And...
Which makes sense because he's used to despair and just like the sense of hopelessness. That's perfect.
Yeah. I mean, there's like an ESPN interview you can find with him where he talks. I don't remember if it was pegged to an album or what, but, you know, he clearly has a lot of feelings on sort of how bad the Knicks were at the time. I imagine he doesn't feel any better about them now. But, you know, I think as you get older and you realize that the people who you once looked up to as templates for your emotional or intellectual life,
right,
or just normal people, you know, they were just out having fun and then they would clock in and record Personal Jesus.
Yeah.
And then they would go back to, you know, downtime.
Right.
I found that really endearing.
Right. So let's get back to Violator specifically. What's your fire track off this album?
I mean, my favorite song is "Enjoy the Silence." I just like everything about how the composition. I think "Halo" is sort of the track that I discovered later in life that I really love. And you know, when you're younger, you discover things, and the way you discover them becomes sort of central to your understanding of what that is, right? And so, I think once you realize that the artists you love were influenced in turn by these other things that you're unaware of, like this entire lineage of music becomes just more accessible, but just like also more mystical in a way. And so, you know, when you listen to something like Halo, I'm like, oh, well, this is exactly what Nine Inch Nails has been trying to, this is sort of the song that they were trying to make at that time. But I like pretty much all the songs. I mean, I do just like that it's a pretty concise album. The songs are, I think it clocks in around 45 minutes.
Yeah. It's just 9 songs. I think there's been like deluxe reissues that extend it. And so if you discover this album through Spotify, you would think this album's about 40% longer than it was. But when it came out in 1990, it was just 9 songs, about 42, 43 minutes total. Yeah.
Yeah. And it just sort of goes to a lot of different emotional places, most of them kind of muted and dark, but but they convey, they sort of mine that territory in an interesting way for me.
To me, so much of this music is separated from a sense of what year things came out. And this is very different than my relationship to hip-hop, where a 1992 hip-hop song to me sounds very different than a 94 song versus a 97. And for whatever reason, and maybe it's because I just was very young when a lot of this music came out, the Passion, New Order, and all these modern rock groups, I just didn't have a sense of like how to temporalize them. And so listening to this, if you had told me that Halo had come out 5 years earlier, I would have been like, sure. Like, I would have believed anything in a way that I wouldn't do with, I think, other genres, in which I intensely understand kind of the discographic history of those. And I don't know if it's because there is something consistent in the sound that doesn't really necessarily change from, you know, half decade to half decade, or it's simply that I'm just ignorant as to like, oh, no, they're doing something completely different here that they weren't doing like 4 years ago.
Yeah, and I think with this album, they were clearly more... It seemed like they were trying harder to make songs that would play on like modern rock radio. A lot of the songs off their previous albums, even ones that sort of rocked in some conventional sense, seemed a little ambivalent about that. You know, this is 1990. The whole notion of alternative rock is sort of getting off the ground. Within a year, the entire notion of modern rock and college rock would sort of become irrelevant once Nirvana appears. And so I think what you see here is a band that's trying to kind of get ahead of that. Not necessarily those things that didn't happen yet, but, you know, this is more of an attempt to make something that will actually play with rock audiences. They had this huge audience already.
Right.
But some of those early songs, like a song like Somebody, which I still listen to quite a bit, like there are no drums. Like it's really just this... it's really just a piano ballad.
But at the end of it all, she will understand me.
Like, that's a song that doesn't have percussion until the very end. And so this album feels a bit more like muscular in that way. And it seems as though it was sort of an intentional choice to just make something that moved in that direction. And you see that a lot more in the next album, Songs of Faith and Devotion. And I remember the first single off that was I Want You. And that song really feels like an attempt to do something that can sort of stand shoulder to shoulder with like what U2 was doing at the time.
Yeah.
Just sort of transitioning out of being this
kind of underground dance group.
Yeah. And like at the time, dance music was becoming more of its own kind of fully fleshed thing as well. So, you know, I think they were trying to pivot toward something different.
When you talk about the muscularity, I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is actually my favorite moment off of this album, which comes about 6 seconds into Personal Jesus, which is when the guitars drop in.
Mm-hmm. Reach out, touch faith.
It has that sort of, thick rockabilly guitar mm-hmm. to it. It was really unexpected because it was not consistent with what I typically thought of as a Depeche sound.
Yeah.
And it certainly gave the song a very aggressive, masculine, if you will, posture just from, you know, from jump, basically.
Yeah. I think one thing I'm always drawn to, and it's something that you hear throughout the history of like British rock, British pop. You see it in U2 right around this time as well. But you know, a lot of bands that aren't from America grew up really steeped in the mythos of American music
mm-hmm.
and American blues, R&B,
sure.
rock. And so around this time, you have like U2 doing Rattle and Hum and Joshua Tree.
Right.
And them trying to kind of really imbibe this Americanness that, mm-hmm. you know, the Rolling Stones had done decades earlier. And so Personal Jesus to me is that, but it's not lame, you know? Like, I agree that it does have this kind of weird traces of rockabilly,
yeah.
This kind of bluesy figure, and yet it still sounds undeniably them,
sure.
even though it doesn't necessarily have the that kind of like murky weirdness of the song, of the albums that had preceded this.
Yeah. Along these lines, the first thing that I think about in terms of this idea of these European groups embracing these slices of Americana, I mean, Depeche does the same thing 2 years prior to this off of Music for the Masses with their cover of Route 66. And this cover, when I was growing up listening to it, because I had heard this before I ever heard the original, who I don't even remember who did the original, which I'm apologies to fans of the original, because again, this was my introduction to Route 66. This song has not, to me, aged well, only insofar as it really now feels, at the time, it didn't strike me as unusual from the Depeche Mode catalog, just because it was kind of ubiquitous here in LA, because we are the home of Route 66 in Southern California. Listening to it now, I feel like Personal Jesus takes some of those same basic ideas in terms of what it's playing with in terms of American rock style and rock guitar and executes on it better. But Route 66, for whatever reason, actually sounds more anemic now than it did when I was first listening to it back in the mid-late 80s.
Yeah, it feels a little too faithful, you know. But, you know, talking about this reminds me of an earlier song of theirs I love, Behind the Wheel.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't care.
I just always thought that was a funny song because it's like a road song.
Right.
You know, it's a song about getting in the car and just like escaping. But it's delivered in this way that feels very British and sort of absent the context a lot of those songs are written. Like Route 66 is like an American song about American road. And the idea of that kind of road trip song feels very American. I don't know if that just me being an exceptionalist. but Behind the Wheel, just seeing it almost ends up sounding ironic as a result, even though I don't necessarily think it was.
You mentioned that Halo was a song that I think in terms of our taxonomy here in Heat Rocks would be the slow burner, right? It's a song that you didn't necessarily love from jump, but that over time you've grown to appreciate. But when I asked you for what your fire track was, the first one you mentioned is, I think, the really, besides Personal Jesus, the other biggest hit off this album, is Enjoy the Silence.
All I ever wanted, all I ever needed is here in my arms. Words are very unnecessary. They can only do harm.
I don't know if this is necessarily my favorite song off of the album, but it's certainly the one where if you catch me at the right time on the dance floor, of any of the songs on this, it's the one that'll get me moving. And it just has that, such a classic synth pop, but more specifically like the Depeche dance style that in a certain way kind of goes to me all the way back to their first big hit, which is Just Can't Get Enough, which is from 10 years earlier.
Yeah.
Vince Clark was the first vocalist and then was later replaced by Dave Gahan. But there was something deeply consistent about if Depeche was sitting out to put together a song that was going to burn up some dance, you know, a dance floor and pull all of us Asian kids off the wall. This is like the formula here is somehow perfect. And I'm not sure what exactly those dimensions are apart from like the kind of squeeginess of the bass lines and the synth and, you know, the tempo set by those quantized drums. But it's kind of perfect for what it is.
Yeah, and it kind of gets back to that weird tension at the heart of so many of these songs I love. I mean, it feels like a song that's just constantly rising. You know, there's this sort of like ascendant feel to it. Mm. And I still remember, you know, I think one of the reasons I always go back to this album, it didn't necessarily set me down a musical path. Like, it's not like I then became obsessed with everything that sounded like Violator.
Yeah.
But it was sort of this pivotal identity creation, finding emotional meaning in music kind of thing that was really like a crossroads for me. And Enjoy the Silence always just reminds me of listening to the radio for the first time because growing up in the Bay Area, I listened to Live 105, the modern rock station. And during that period of time when I started listening to Live 105, they would always use a few seconds of Enjoy the Silence for their promos.
Oh.
And so for a while, I actually thought that was just music that was the radio station's theme music or their jingle.
Yeah.
But anyhow, it's like, it's a very ascendant song. Like, it's a song that just as notes, as like vibrations, like it feels uplifting. And yet the lyrics are kind of like, you know, like Enjoy the Silence, like words are unnecessary. It doesn't necessarily lift you up in quite the same way. In fact, it sort of makes you question the possibilities of communication to begin with. And so, you know, I've always kind of appreciated that about it.
One of the things that surprised me to learn, number one, I didn't realize that this was the group's most popular album. And I was very surprised to learn that for many folks, even though, Kwa, you had said earlier that for deep Depeche fans, Violator is not necessarily going to be their number one album. But on a global level, this album really catapulted them to levels of success that, as I said in my intro, I already thought that they were world famous by the time that I went to that 101 concert, but Violator sort of took them to some other level that I didn't know that could exist. And as a consequence of it, it astonished me to learn how many people have covered songs off of this album. I think it has to be somewhere near the ballpark of around 100. Most obviously, you have Johnny Cash's take on Personal Jesus, which makes a lot of sense. Like, that song itself, as we're saying, it has kind of a rockabilly feel to it. Someone like a Johnny Cash could, certainly he could take it on.
Your own personal Jesus. Someone to hear your prayers. Someone to care.
I also hadn't realized that Tori Amos had covered Enjoy the Silence in a version which I think is not what you would describe as being particularly ascendant.
Oh, my little girl, all I ever wanted, all I ever needed is here in my arms.
Personally, I found myself really enjoying what I would describe as the off-kilter covers. And that includes the Jazzy Sticks doing Personal Jesus as a really boozy lounge ballad.
Feeling alone and you're all alone. Flesh and bone by the telephone. Lift up your receiver, I'll make you a believer.
And by far, my favorite thing I found in going through the covers from Violator is by the St. Petersburg Ska Jazz Review doing their version of Policy of Truth.
Mm-hmm.
If you had to choose a song off here that you would like to hear a contemporary artist cover, do you have a song and do you have an artist?
Yeah, I would love to hear Frank Ocean cover Enjoy the Silence.
So this is clearly someone who's listened to our show a lot because...
Is that what everyone says?
Oh, I thought you were riffing on the fact that we make fun of the fact that the answer to this question is always going to be Frank Ocean because there's nothing that he can't. So, but the fact that you actually just chose that without making a joke from at our expense is fantastic. It just goes to a point. Is there nothing that Frank Ocean can't do? Why Frank and why that song?
Just because I think in a weird way, what Frank does is kind of similar to how I feel about Violator.
Mm.
You know, I think he's really good at, and it's funny you mentioned like affect theory at the beginning of this is something I'd recently written about.
Right.
Like, I think what I'm drawn to is really the affect of this album. And it's something that I can't really put into words. Like, I haven't really been able to describe the music, but it's very powerful to me as a set of feelings. And the feelings are kind of confusing. And I think that's what Frank's music does for a lot of his big fans. I mean, yeah. He's a great lyricist. Like, the music sounds good, but I think he just sort of scrambles our sense of, like, you know, who we are and what it means to love and to be. And so I think that's why, like, a lot of these songs would sound good if a competent band or a competent singer sang them, but it would just be interesting to hear him kind of try and inhabit that space.
Right, right. Given that you've revisited this album at different points in your life, I'm wondering, when you listen to Violator now, what do you hear differently than you perhaps didn't hear when you first were introduced to it via Johan, your cousin, back in 1990?
I think now I just hear how it's part of a continuum. Mm. I think at the time I didn't understand like where this music had come from, but now I kind of recognize what went into it, what came out of it. I think I also just understand that the lyrics aren't necessarily meant to be like manifestos for living. You know, just that the lyrics don't necessarily power this album, but they're just sort of a general like feeling it conveys that's just as strong as it ever was before.
Yeah.
And I think I kind of stay in those moments of you know, near despair versus ascendancy in a different way than I did before.
Would you say that Violator was right on time, ahead of its time, or timeless?
You know, I think the historical record shows that it was like perfectly timed, you know, because it really, even before I knew the history about it being the first piece of music that folks in like the former East Germany could listen to, like, it always sounded very kind of capacious and global to me. Mm-hmm. Like, there was just something about it that sounded in 1990 like this was future pop music. You know, this was future rock music.
Yeah. Even though it wasn't, as you're saying, because
yeah,
Nirvana and grunge just completely flipped that script.
Yeah, I was just, a 12-year-old casting about for an identity, so.
Right, right. If you had to describe Violator in three words, what would you choose?
Dude, I knew you were going to ask this.
Yes, you listened to the show.
I never thought to think of an answer.
It's all good. It's all good.
You know, it's weird, but what comes to mind is like black, red, and white, because the album cover is a red rose with like a white outline against a black background. And maybe that just speaks to how mystical of an object it was in 1990.
Mm.
You know, it's also like cold yet human, but for whatever reason, you saying the word just makes me think of that.
Violator, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is tough because then when Violator came out, when the Chris Lighty Violator thing came out, it really scrambled my,
Which also, like, their logo is also black and red.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wonder if... Well, they didn't take it from Depeche Mode.
They took it from the
Violators, which is like a Brooklyn gang, right? But yeah. Something about the name, though, seems to stick with that.
Yeah.
Well, that will do it for this episode of Heat Rocks with our special guest, Hua Xu. What are you working on now?
Right now, we're wrapping up an exhibition at the Museum of Chinese in America in New York City. It's called The Moon Represents My Heart. It's about kind of music and Chinese American life. It's a really kind of it's more of like a mixtape than a show. It's very free associative. We've had a blast doing it. Shout out to Herb Tam and Andrew Rabata, my co-curators. And there's going to be a lot of embarrassing pictures of like Asian American people in the 80s with Depeche Mode t-shirts as part of it.
Nice, nice. Are my boys, the Mountain Brothers, represented in this exhibit?
Yeah, Mountain Brother. It spans the gamut from like Mountain Brothers to Yo-Yo Ma to Tiger Parents to Teresa Tang. Like it's pretty much all over the place.
The Chinese diaspora contains multitudes is, I think, really what we're saying here.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Hua, where can people find you online?
You could follow my work at the New Yorker website. And I'm occasionally on Twitter, at Hua Su, but every now and then...
You just dip out.
Yeah.
It just kind of flares on and off.
Yeah.
Well, Hua, thank you so much for coming today. This was really, really fun.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. You've been listening to Heat Rocks with me, Oliver Wong. Morgan Rhodes will be back next week. Our theme music is Crown Ones by Thess One, People Under the Stairs. Shout out to Thess for the hookup. Heat Rocks is produced by myself and Morgan alongside Christian Duenas, who also edits, engineers, and does the booking for our shows. Senior producer is Laura Swisher, and exec producer is Jesse Thorne. We are part of the Maximum Fun family, taping every week live in their studios in the Westlake neighborhood of Los Angeles, where you may or may not find your own personal Jesus. Be sure to follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Heat Rocks Pod. You can find a link to our Facebook group on our webpage, heatrockspod.com. That's where we'll post show notes for every episode, including a track listing of everything that you've heard today and other goodies. Again, that's at heatrockspod.com. One last thing. Here is a teaser for next week's episode, which is a purple special episode where we will be rerunning a compilation of three of our great Prince episodes. So, Morgan, we've talked about, I think, previously how there's only a handful of artists who have made it to the Triple Crown, Prince, of course, being one of them, I think the first one. Do you ever imagine that there would be a fourth Prince album that we might discuss? And if so, what is the one that you would most like to get into?
I've said this on other shows, and until Illa J came, and I had to reconsider for a few minutes, Around the World in a Day is my favorite.
Mm.
Not a lot of people choose that as their favorite.
It's kind of slept on, which is weird because it had such great hits on it. Yeah.
Pop Life.
Oh, my God.
Raspberry Beret.
Yeah.
I mean, just those by itself are great.
Right.
Tambourine, Temptation, America. So that would be one... I don't want to say too much about this album because I hope someone comes on and talks about this album.
Yeah.
But people don't bring that up. I love Dirty Mind, and I love it more now that we had that conversation because I appreciate it more. But I'm surprised no one's come and talked about Sign of the Times. So that's probably the third one I would think.
Yeah.
Or the fourth one I think that someone would come in and talk about. Big album, but no one's come. We're the Sign of the Times people.
Right.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.